Remember what it was like to be running late before you could just send a text? That feeling.
Oh, absolutely.
You're either there or you weren't. There was no map pin, no on my way
Yeah.
notification. You just had to show up and wait and deal with that pure, agonizing uncertainty.
Or, think about browsing, like walking into a Blockbuster or a record store and just being paralyzed by thousands of choices. And you just pick something based on what? The cover art.
Yeah, a weird title. Sometimes it was awful.
Often it was life-changing. You were trusting pure, unmediated, random discovery.
Exactly. And that feeling, that trust in the unexpected, is what we're really digging into here. Our central idea, and it's a big one, is that the 1990s were probably the last decade of genuinely unmediated
Where
experience.
the default setting was direct contact with the world, not an algorithmically tweaked simulation of it.
And the thing is, all those limitations, those constraints, they weren't just inconvenient. They actually built certain skills in us that
Well,
that we've let erode.
things like the capacity to just sit with boredom,
Yeah.
or the ability to actually commit to a plan because you couldn't just text and change it five times.
Genuine random encounters. And I think this is the big one, just the space to live your life instead of constantly curating it for an audience.
Right.
So it's a massive topic. We've got a lot of sources to pull from. So here's the roadmap for you. First, we're going to pinpoint the exact moment technology sort of broke reality.
Then we'll look at why a film like The Matrix was less sci-fi and more of a prophecy.
We'll also examine what happens when all our content is optimized for predictability. And finally, we'll look at some actual practical ways we can try to reclaim some of the real in this always-on world. So let's start with a timeline. I mean, this didn't happen overnight, but
Yeah.
when did we cross that line? Where did reality, break?
Well, the cultural technologists who study this, people like Dr. Michael Torres, they point to a very specific window, 1996 to 2007.
Okay, that's a decade.
Right. And it wasn't just about computers getting faster. It was a fundamental change in how we interacted with the world and with each other.
So what kicked it off in 96?
Two things, really. First was the Nokia 9000 communicator. It was like the earliest version of a phone with real internet access, the seed of the smartphone.
I remember that brick.
Yeah. And the second thing, which was maybe even more disruptive, was the launch of ICQ.
The instant messenger.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Why was that so important?
Because it made asynchronous communication mainstream. Before that, a phone call was, it was a commitment. You were both there, present, at the same time.
Right, synchronous.
With ICQ, you could just fire off a message and walk away. You could start contact without committing to the conversation. And that slowly created this expectation of a delayed response. It eroded the need for immediate full presence.
So the seeds were there, but the internet was still a place.
Yeah.
You sat down, you heard the dial-up modem screaming.
And then you logged off.
Yeah. So when did it stop being a place and start being just the
Oh,
air?
that's 2007, the iPhone. It wasn't just a better phone. It was a total environmental shift. The internet was no longer at a desk. It was in your pocket, always on, always updating.
And that's the key distinction for you, the listener. It went from a place you visit to the environment you inhabit, which means you're never really unreachable.
And maybe more importantly, you're never fully offline in your own head.
Right.
Dr. Torres calls this ambient anxiety. It's that low-grade hum of stress from the feeling that something, somewhere needs your attention, even when your phone is silent. The 90s just didn't have that.
And this constant connection completely destroyed our boredom threshold. Boredom used to be the default state of waiting. Now it feels like a crisis.
The statistics on this are, honestly, they're terrifying. In the 90s, research suggests the average person had maybe 3 to 4 hours of genuinely unstructured, empty time a day.
Just nothing time. Waiting, daydreaming.
Exactly. By 2020, that number had dropped to around 45 minutes.
Wow. And I think we all feel that, but what happens when you try to force people into that empty space?
That's where this coffee shop experiment is so revealing. Researchers asked 30 people to just sit in a coffee shop for 10 minutes. No phone, no book, no writing, just.
Just exist for 10 minutes.
The average person quit in 6 minutes.
6 minutes.
Yeah, they couldn't do it. People reported this overwhelming discomfort, this physical urge to do something. They said it felt like climbing out of their skin, where they felt this crushing guilt about all the things they should be doing.
So 6 minutes of quiet, which was just a normal part of waiting for a bus, is now unbearable. That's not just a change in habit. That's a change in our brains.
Yeah.
We've trained ourselves to see quiet as inefficient.
We have.
It's just wild that this exact feeling, this whole shift, was captured perfectly in pop culture right as it was happening. I'm talking about The Matrix.
March 1999, right on the cusp.
Yeah, we all watched it and thought, wow, cool sci-fi.
But the real warning wasn't about evil robots. It was about a simulated, mediated reality that is so comfortable, so optimized, that you willingly choose it over the messy, difficult, real world.
So the blue pill, choosing the comfortable lie. How do we see that today?
It's in the architecture of every app you use. These platforms aren't just showing you things. They're showing you the perfectly engineered version of reality designed to trigger an emotion, anger, envy, desire, just to keep your eyes on the screen.
So Neo's question, what is real, becomes, are we actually interacting with reality, or are we just in a feedback loop of our own worst instincts, packaged and sold back to us?
That's it, exactly. The simulation is so insidious because it uses real data, your fears, your clicks, to build a world that isn't true, but is perfectly optimized to keep you engaged. The technology stopped being a tool and became the environment. And when the environment is mediated, it's hard to tell the difference.
We hear this all the time from listeners, that feeling of being at a concert, but only seeing it through your phone screen. Or wondering if a great moment, a sunset, even happened if you didn't post it. And this brings us to the actual content itself. If the whole environment is mediated, what happens to the art? You look at 90s movies and they were often simpler. Good guys, bad guys. Now everything feels so layered and meta and self-aware. Why?
Because the person in creative control has changed. It used to be a creator, an artist with a vision. Now it's increasingly an algorithm deciding what gets promoted based on predictive models.
Can you break down how that works for us?
It's basically microsegmentation at scale. The algorithm knows that you, based on the last 1,000 videos you watched, will respond positively to a certain color palette or a joke that lands at the 32-second mark. So content creation becomes about plugging in variables that are known to work.
And if everything is optimized for what worked before, what's the casualty?
Genuine surprise.
Surprise.
Surprise breaks the pattern. It's risky. An algorithm's job is to eliminate risk, and the result is what we have now. Endless predictable sequels, reboots, franchises, and pop music that all chases the same sonic signals. It's high volume, low diversity, and almost zero actual shock.
But hold on, isn't that just good business? I mean, if people are clicking on the 9th sequel, isn't the algorithm just giving them what they want?
That is the essential question, isn't it? It's a feedback loop. It feeds you what you liked before, which reinforces those tastes, which trains you to prefer predictability. It shrinks the universe of what's possible. In the 90s, a record executive might take a huge risk on a band that sounded like nothing else, just on a gut feeling.
Now data replaces the gut.
Precisely. The system prefers predictable success over a revolutionary failure.
That shrinking universe. It makes me think of what we lost with physical spaces. I remember spending like 2 hours in a Blockbuster aisle, just wandering and walking out with some bizarre foreign film that completely rewired my brain.
That's where new taste is formed.
Yeah.
In that directionless browsing. But that's a capacity we've outsourced. There's this great quote from Chen Wei, who runs a record store in New York. He says, customers who grew up on streaming algorithms are paralyzed by choice.
They can't choose.
They literally come in and ask, what is Spotify telling me I should like right now? They've outsourced the entire messy, wonderful process of forming their own taste. And that's critical because human taste is supposed to be messy. You can love death metal and also, I don't know, 17th century folk music. The algorithm wants you to be predictable.
This obsession with optimizing everything leads to this next point. The need to document everything. I saw this chaotic arrest on the street the other day, and the most shocking thing about it was that no one was filming. And because of that, it felt so much more immediate, more real.
That feeling is actually backed up by cognitive science. There's something called the photo-taking impairment effect.
Okay.
It's the brain's offloading hypothesis. The research shows that the act of filming or photographing an experience actually impairs your memory of it.
So you remember less if you film it. That sounds completely backwards.
It does, right. But the theory is that your brain essentially outsources the job of remembering. It says, okay, the device has this. I don't need to put it in deep storage. So you end up remembering the video, the filtered story, not the full feeling of being there. You train yourself to be a documentarian, not a participant.
And this constant documentation, this reliance on external scripts, brings us to this term we have to talk about, the NPC, the non-player character phenomenon.
Right. It's often used as an insult, but the mechanism behind it is It's fascinating. It describes people who seem to be operating on like downloaded scripts instead of their own complex thoughts.
How does that connect back to the 90s?
Well, think about how you had to form an opinion in the 90s. If someone asked you a hard question about politics, about art, whatever, you had to generate the answer yourself from scratch.
It might be messy and wrong, but it was yours.
Exactly. You couldn't just Google the perfect prepackaged 10-point answer. That search process, that internal struggle is gone. Now we can just download a fully formed script, a liberal script, a fitness bro script, and it bypasses that entire difficult, essential process of forging your own ideas. You become a repeater of information, an NPC.
Okay, so if we can't uninstall modernity, we have to shift our focus.
Yeah.
It's not about what we lost, it's about what we can reclaim. Can we actually get back to the real?
We have to. And it comes down to one thing. Intentionality. You have to actively swim against the current. It means choosing boredom. It means committing to plans without a digital safety net. It means deleting the apps that want to mediate your whole life.
I love that 90s day experiment that one of our sources
heard. Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
The person turned off their smartphone, used a cheap flip phone, no Google, just pre-printed maps. And they said at first it was terrifying.
Terrifying.
A profound sense of vulnerability. They felt totally exposed, knowing they couldn't just be instantly rescued or look something up. But then,
what was the payoff?
The feeling of time itself changed. It slowed down. The boredom while waiting for a friend wasn't anxiety anymore. It was nice, a space to think. Mm-hmm. And every interaction felt so present because there was no phone to pull out, no notification to expect. They were just there, fully.
And that's the heart of it. That's what we traded for convenience. We lost the capacity for boredom, the seriousness of commitment, the joy of random discovery, and the space to have an original messy thought.
And that's the challenge for you listening right now. The fight isn't against technology. It's a fight to preserve your own capacity to be surprised. And that means you have to create protected spaces, a library, a park, your own mind, where the algorithms can't reach in and optimize your experience for you.
You know, the Matrix asked, what is real? And we thought it was a philosophical question, but it's not. It's intensely practical now. So you have to ask yourself, is your life real if you're living it mainly for the documentation instead of for the experience itself? The 90s was the last time we didn't have to ask that question every single day.
So we'll leave you with a simple starting point right now. After this, put your phone down, put it somewhere out of reach, and just choose to be intentionally bored for 10 minutes. Let your mind wander. See what original, unmediated thought finally comes to the surface.